From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Sequestration was supposed to be a kind of doomsday pact so ugly, so dumb, that Congress would never actually do it. And now, it appears, we're about to do it. MEDAX, federal spending cuts from the military to research to food inspection, slated to kick in a week from Friday. Even people who very much want to cut are shaking their heads. This hour on Point, budget by blackmail, why we're here on sequestration and what it means. You can join the conversation. Have you figured out what is coming at us if, when sequestration kicks in? Does it look like doomsday? Just dumb? The only way to cut? Why can't we act smarter? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Everybody's shaking their heads. Here was CBS's Bob Schieffer on Sunday. Had enough. Went editorial saying you'd think Washington could come together when faced with a huge threat, but he said you'd be wrong.
Well, guess what? Even Washington managed to underestimate its own ineptitude. The sequester and the draconian cuts are about to happen because the White House and Congress cannot close the partisan divide and figure out what to do about them.
Today, everybody's talking about them. The president this morning, Erskine Bowles and Alan Simpson. Simpson Bowles been out in front of the press today. Here was Erskine Bowles. These, of course, were the two who put out a big failed budget-cutting plan that never got traction. But anyway, they tried. They're back again today saying, don't go this way. Simpson, Republican. Bowles, Democrat. Here's Bowles.
And they are stupid, stupid, stupid. They're stupid because, first of all,
they're inane.
They are inane. You couldn't look. There's no business in the country that makes its cuts across the board. You go in there and you try to surgically cut those things that have the least adverse effect on productivity. Second, they're cutting those areas where we actually need to invest, education, infrastructure, research. And third, they don't make any cuts in those things that are growing faster than the economy. That's stupid, stupid, stupid.
Stupid, stupid, stupid. Great. But here we are. Nancy Cook covers the budget for the National Journal. Nancy, thank you very much for being with us today.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Is there some chance, any chance, that before a week from Friday, this thing will be, shunted off and won't happen? Or is it just up on the rails? It's coming at us, Nancy.
It seems like it's coming at us. I spent a lot of time on Capitol Hill talking with different congressional members and staffers last week, and everyone, privately really thought that this was, a train that had left the station and that sequestration was definitely going to happen. I think what we're seeing now is, both sides, neither side wants to get the blame for it. So, everyone's sort of positioning themselves to look like they're very willing people who are ready to compromise and come up with a deal. But at this point, it seems like it's going to happen. It's just a matter of which party takes the blame for it.
Can you roll the tape back just slightly? I mean, we bought this line that this was so ugly that it would never happen. Did Congress really believe that back in 2011 when this was put in place?
I think there was a sense that it would lead to some compromise. You have to remember that this came about right after the debt ceiling fight, where the Republicans were negotiating with the White House to raise the debt ceiling. It seemed like we were potentially going to default, which would have been a terrible moment for the economy. And so they came up with this Budget Control Act and created the Super Committee, which, as you know, couldn't reach a compromise. And part of the deal was, if there was no compromise, we would have this sequestration that would hit. So, that was about a year and a half ago, and I think there was a sense then that surely people would be able to come to the table by this point. That hasn't been the case, and Washington has just become more and more divided on these big budget discussions.
Now, last week there were hearings on what it will mean when and if these cuts across the board kick in. Can you describe them generally for us, Nancy? What's vulnerable and what's not? Defense very much included here and a lot of domestic spending, but not, as I understand, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid.
Yeah, that's right. So in 2013, there will be about $85 billion that will be cut, and that's about 9% from non-defense programs and 13% from defense. Medicare, some payments to providers and hospitals would be cut, but no Medicare benefits would be cut for people. Social Security is off the table, and other programs for low-income people are exempt. So it's really sort of this 50-50 split between, programs that are non-defense and defense. And the hearing got into a lot of specifics about how kids would be kicked off of Head Start, how there would be cuts to loan guarantees for small businesses, furloughs for food inspectors, cuts to research, cuts to the Defense Department. So the list sort of goes on and on because it is these across-the-board cuts.
Here was Janet Napolitano, of course, Homeland Security Secretary, former governor of Arizona, talking before the Senate Appropriations Committee last week, saying it would mean big layoffs, thousands, including Border Patrol agents, airport screeners, customs agents.
Furloughs of transportation security officers will increase domestic passenger wait times at our busiest airports by more than 1 hour. On the southwest border, our biggest land ports could face waits of 5 hours or more, functionally closing these ports during core hours.
That's to legally come into or exit the U.S. If you're coming in illegally, fewer Border Patrol agents. From the Pentagon, Deputy Secretary of Defense Ashton Carter was before the same committee, quoting the Joint Chiefs of Staff, saying, "We are on the brink of creating a hollow force," that is, in the U.S. military. And he lamented the across-the-board defense cuts were happening, he said, for all the wrong reasons.
What's particularly tragic is that sequestration is not the result of an economic recession or an emergency. It's not because discretionary spending cuts are the answer to our nation's fiscal challenge. You do the math. It's not in reaction to a more peaceful world. It's not due to a breakthrough in military technology or to a new strategic insight. It's not because paths of entitlement growth and spending have been explored and exhausted. It's not because sequestration was ever a plan intended to be implemented. All this is purely the collateral damage of political gridlock.
Everybody's shaking their heads. Responsibility, nobody wants to be left holding it entirely. On that committee, Maine Republican Senator Susan Collins said there's blame to go around.
The fact is there's plenty of blame to go around for the crisis that we find ourselves in. But there can be no doubt that these indiscriminate cuts represent an utter failure to set priorities. And we simply cannot allow sequestration to go into effect. If we do so, we might as well just pack up and go home.
Nancy, what about Alan Simpson and Erskine Bowles this morning? Do they have any great idea about what could happen right now in the next week and a half to shunt this off?
Well, they're really talking about pushing a big compromise. Their new plan that they have calls for $2.4 trillion in deficit reduction. I haven't had a chance to read the whole thing. They just unveiled it this morning. But, you know, that sort of call for a big deficit reduction deal has not gotten a lot of traction in Washington over the last year. Although they've become very visible and very vocal advocates for deficit reduction, it just doesn't seem like it's something in the cards over the next few months, particularly since we only have a week and a half to undo the sequester. You know, Congress isn't even here this week. They're all on recess, and they're not back till early next week. So it seems like, you know, we're just running out of legislative time to actually get this done.
Simpson-Bowles putting out $2.4 trillion, what, grand bargain if it were actually come to pass. Republicans looking for $4 trillion in cuts over the next decade. The White House putting out $1.2 trillion. So Simpson-Bowles kind of looking to split the difference there. They had no traction last time. The president's going to be out in front of a bunch of first responders today, emergency responders, talking about this. What's the White House line at this point on sequestration? Is there anything that they're saying that might indicate, you know, an alternative before it kicks in?
Well, the White House is really trying to push this back on Congress. So they've only recently started to detail the cuts and kind of what would happen there through the Office of Management and Budget, which is sort of the White House budgetary arm. And they've really started to go into great detail. And then the president now is starting to play this outside game, similar to the way he played with the fiscal cliff, where he really wanted to build support with the public and try to, you know, blame Congress for this, urge Congress to act. And at that point, that's really the message of the White House trying to urge Congress to do something. And, you know, the White House is saying they're still open to some sort of deal. They're open to some cuts to Medicare, you know, some entitlement cuts, but they're not necessarily making the first move in terms of saying, you know, here's a specific new plan that we want.
Nancy, what about ardent budget cutters? Are they out there who say, well, it's ugly, it'll be bloody, it's stupid, but at least it's cutting, bring it on?
Well, that's really the Republican thinking at this point. You know, there was the fiscal cliff deal. We averted the fiscal cliff in January. that called for raising taxes. But the Republicans, as part of that deal, did not get spending cuts that they wanted to see, nor did they get any changes to entitlement programs like Medicare or Medicaid or Social Security. And those are things that are really important to them. So the Republican line of thinking at this point is that, yes, the cuts would be bad, but at least they are some of the spending cuts that we're looking for. And we'll pocket those, move on, and try to get some more changes to entitlements in the coming months.
What about the Democrats? Are they so wedded to keeping Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid as is that they're willing, they'd rather take sequestration hits than not?
I don't think the Democrats think that sequestration is a great idea, but you have to keep in mind that sequestration also exempts a lot of the low-income programs for people, and that's really a cornerstone of the Democrat ideology. So it exempts those, it exempts benefits for Medicare. And so I think that they are worried about sequestration, but there's not this, huge level of angst necessarily about undoing it at this point.
And the hit to the economy quickly, Nancy, could this drag it down? Not just a hit, but recession?
I don't know if it would be a recession, but people are estimating that it could cost the economy as much as 1 million jobs. And that's a big hit in 2013 as we're slowly recovering.
Nancy Cook with National Journal joining us from Washington. Nancy, thanks very much for getting us going here.
Thanks.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about sequestration right in front of us now. What it will look like, mean if it hits, why we're at this point. Everybody lined up last week talking about what the impact would be. We heard from Homeland Security. We heard from the Defense Department. Here was Secretary of Education Arne Duncan before the Senate Appropriations Committee last week saying sequestration would do terrible harm to the education of America's children.
When the cuts hit, not surprisingly, they will hurt the most vulnerable students the worst, because federal education resources generally are targeted to those children with the greatest need. Doing that to our most vulnerable children is educational malpractice, economically foolish, and morally indefensible.
Here was Republican Senator John McCain, Arizona, on NBC's Meet the Press on Sunday, taking some blame and giving some blame.
Republicans deserve blame. I'll take some blame for it. But the President of the United States is supposed to lead. Why doesn't he call people over and we sit down and prevent the sequestration from happening rather than say, and fulfill the comment that he made during the campaign that sequester, quote, won't happen?
And here is Rand Paul, Senator Rand Paul, Republican, Kentucky, a Tea Party response to the State of the Union address. He's one of those who's not afraid of sequestration cuts. In fact, once more.
Not only should the sequester stand, many pundits say the sequester's far short, that we need $4 trillion in cuts.
One way or another, it looks like we are on our way to these cuts in this fiscal year. Let's look at this picture. Dan Mitchell joins us right now from Washington, senior fellow at the Cato Institute, served as economist under Senator Bob Packwood on the Senate Finance Committee, served on the 1988 Bush-Quayle transition team. Dan Mitchell, thanks very much for being with us.
Glad to be on the program.
Scott Lilly is with us from the Center for American Progress, was 31 years as a congressional staffer on the House Appropriations Committee, as executive director of the House Democratic Study Group, was chief of staff in the office of Congressman David Obey of Wisconsin, Democrat. Scott Lilly, thank you for being here.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Dan, why is this happening?
It's happening almost as an accident that was put in as a backstop when we had the debt limit legislation back in 2011. The expectation was that the so-called super committee was going to come up with something and the sequester was just there in case they didn't. And, of course, they didn't come up with something. Now we have a sequester. I'm in the camp that the sequester is a far better thing than doing nothing. We need to do something to control the growth of government spending. As a matter of fact, I would argue the whole thing is ridiculously overhyped because, according to the most recent CBO numbers, if we do nothing, government spending grows $2.5 trillion over the next 10 years. If we do the sequester, it grows $2.4 trillion over the next 10 years. Now, is anybody going to actually say with a straight face that the difference between $2.4 trillion more spending and $2.5 trillion more spending is going to cause all these supposedly horrible things that all these political hacks were talking about at that committee? I mean, it's nonsense.
Political hacks, you mean the cabinet of the President of the United States?
when they're out there lying to the American people and acting like aircraft carriers won't be able to sail, that it's going to take you an extra hour to get through airline security. I mean, if those things actually happen, then we should immediately fire those bureaucrats and appointees and replace them with someone who can do what households and businesses all across the country do all the time, which is make do without as big of increases as they otherwise would want.
Scott Lilly, what about that charge that departments of the government are taking these cuts and allowing them to be expressed in the most painful and political painful ways as a kind of protest against this rather than what really needs to happen, that it could be done in a way that's not so egregious? Is that possible, Scott?
Well, let me go back to where this came from and then work into that. This came about despite the fact that the president asked repeatedly for the Congress to pass a debt limit without any type of formulaic spending provisions on it. And not only did he ask for that, but he and Speaker Boehner worked all through the summer of 2011 after the House had rejected a clean debt limit to come up with a compromise. At the last end, at the very last moment when we were on the verge of going into default, the White House finally folded and went along with what the conservative wing of the House Republican caucus had been asking for since the spring, and that was automatic across-the-board cuts. And the law put in great detail how that was to be done, and it took all of the discretion away from the cabinet members. Now, if Dan can convince his allies on the Hill to relinquish that and to give department heads flexibility for the implementation of this, then I think we'd be in an entirely different situation.
Well, two things let me ask you. First, I mean, Bob Woodward says it was Jack Lew that in part proposed this on Obama's team. Is that not right?
Well, I'm afraid Bob is just wrong on that, because if you go back and if you look, the House voted on May 31st of 2011 to reject the clean debt limit. And at that point, Alan West and a number of people that were leading the charge against
hardcore Tea Party, yeah,
said, we're not going to go for this unless we have automatic across-the-board cuts. Now, I think finally Jack Lew said, all right, if that's the only way we can get you to vote for a debt limit, then this is the way to do it. So, you know, I mean, he came up with the technical language to implement that idea.
But and
idea,
here we are. What about, you say no discretion for cabinet secretaries and beyond. Really? I mean, the percentage they have to cut is explicit, but how they make those cuts, don't they have discretion there?
No. They have to cut by program, project, and activity. And that is defined in the original Graham Rudman Hollings law that was passed in 1986. And they have virtually no flexibility in terms of doing it. If the FBI is going to cut agents, if they're going to cut their budget, the only thing they have is personnel, and they've got to cut agents.
So it's not grandstand kind of cuts that are going to get the public most riled up.
It's
showboating.
It's the most boneheaded, ridiculous way to cut the federal budget that you can imagine. And not only do they have very little discretion in terms of what to cut, but they have to pack a tremendous amount of cuts in a very short period of time. Between March 1st and September 30th, they have to cut $85 billion out of discretionary spending.
What about Dan's point? Come on, how big a deal is that? It's $2.5 trillion without it, $2.4 with it. Over 10 years, how serious cuts can that be with that little difference?
There's an old saying in debate, if you can't dazzle them with your brilliance, you baffle them with your BS. And I think that kind of falls in that category. Discretionary spending, the amount that we spend to fund the 15 departments of the government on all of the activities and services of the federal government is declining. It's declining in terms of, as a percentage of GDP. It's declining in terms of inflation. It's declining in nominal dollars, and it's a huge problem because we can't maintain that level of services. We have big increases in Medicare in Social Security and Medicaid. And those increases, those programs are basically going to double over the next 10 years. So the question that we have to answer as a country is, are we going to pay for those, or are we going to reduce those benefits? And neither party has taken that on very effectively. I think the American people are going to say in the end, we need these programs and we want to have taxes that will cover them.
That's certainly the kind of theme that the White House is striking today. Scott Lilly, Dan Mitchell, stand by. We've got lots of callers from all over. Let's start right in our backyard. Kyle in Boston. Kyle, thanks for calling.
Thank you, Tom. I'm an air traffic controller at one of the largest facilities in New England. I just wanted to make a very quick point that people don't seem to realize just how much the sequester will impact their daily lives. At our facility, at a time when we are already short of controllers because of mandatory retirements, and we're trying to implement the new next-gen air traffic control system, the FAA has said, and this is a fact, this is not a scare statement, they will be cutting 10,000 operational positions in the National Airspace System each day, including the frontline air traffic controllers and the staff that maintain our nation's air traffic control infrastructure. This is not a responsible way to implement the budget cuts we all agree need to happen, and it's certainly not ethical to cut the spending from the paychecks of the federal service sector employees that provide valuable services to the American taxpayers each day. And I'll go take my comment or my remark off the line. Thank
you. Kyle, thank you. We certainly heard a lot about that last theme from hecklers at the Bull-Simpson press meeting today. Dan Mitchell, there's an air traffic controller. It's going to be dropping like flies around him. You say it's no big deal, but that doesn't sound good to me as someone who flies once in a while.
This is just more of what's called the Washington Monument Syndrome, which was a term that was created many, many years ago when the National Park Service was threatened with a tiny bit of restraint on their budget. They said, oh, well, we'll have to close the National Park Service to tourists. Of course, government agencies and departments and bureaucrats and appointees always make it seem as if the world's going to come to an end if they don't get their big budget increases. Again, I come back to what is not BS, as my friend Scott says. It's straight out of the Congressional Budget Office, which, if anything, has very much of a left-wing orientation. And the recent numbers they put out show that government spending grows $2.4 trillion with the sequester, $2.5 trillion without the sequester.
That doesn't mean the air traffic control tower won't be down several positions next time we're flying, does it?
Well, yes, we could say because the sequester only applies to 50% of the budget, it is more of a hassle for the departments and agencies that actually do get affected. But again, how many households, how many businesses have managed to make do just fine with a little bit less money than they were promised or with slower spending increases than they had planned on? And we have instead the scare tactics going out to the American people. Now, I say this as someone who would much prefer, Scott mentioned, oh, we're not dealing with entitlements. The House passed both last year and the year before the Ryan budget that dealt with the out-of-control spending for Medicare and Medicaid. That would be a 100 times smarter way of trying to restrain the burden of government spending than the sequester. But with a president and a Senate that hasn't passed a budget in almost 4 years now, and a president that doesn't seem to understand anything in fiscal policy other than more class warfare tax policy, yeah, we're sort of at a stalemate. And the only thing that's going to possibly limit how fast we become another Greece is the sequester.
Well,
so, yes, I agree with Rand Paul.
You can't have it both ways. It's a big deal or it's not. It's not going to keep us from Greece if it's a peanut. Let me ask you this, though.
It's going to slow down. What I was completely consistent in the way I phrased it.
Slow down your point.
How fast we become Greece.
Listen, Simpson Bowles, they're saying today, let's split the difference here. Obama wants, a trillion and a half in cuts over the next decade. Maybe Paul Ryan wants $4 trillion. They're saying, how about 2.4 and include some new revenues in there? What about it, Dan? Would you go for that? Republican leadership is saying zero new revenues. Would you go for it?
We have a problem with government spending. We don't have a problem with inadequate tax revenue. Even before Obama got his class warfare fiscal cliff proposal through, the
class warfare. Have you seen what's happened with income distribution in this country in the last 30 years? I mean, he doesn't have to raise that for that to be a problem, does he?
Well, I guess you must think that the economy is a fixed pie. So if Bill Gates gets
certainly
a big
not,
slice,
but I can see who's getting what,
slice.
And that's changed a lot, and not in a good way.
That's fundamentally wrong. You don't create more opportunity for the poor by penalizing investors and entrepreneurs and small business owners. But anyhow, the point is about the Obama administration. They got their class warfare tax through, and now they're hoping to use the sequester and, of course, all the scare tactics about the sequester to try to seduce Republicans into another tax increase.
Republicans helped set up the sequester, Dan.
They what?
They helped set it up.
I'm glad they did. I'm glad they did.
Well,
now, of course, you know, Woodward did say it was Jack Lew's idea. I wasn't in the room, so I'm not going to pretend that I know. But I'm glad there is a sequester because I want something done to modestly restrain the growing burden of government spending. I would prefer the Ryan budget, which was much better.
We'll go to that, Scott. Let me get a call from Omaha, Nebraska. Phil, you're on the air.
Hi. This whole process of the sequester is really a making of the Tea Party, and the Tea Party lives in a world that none of us live in. I'm really sorry to say that, but it's really true. The statistics this gentleman's talking about, I just retired from the Social Security Administration, and what's happened in our office before sequester, the office I left,
yep,
is that waiting times have almost tripled, that nobody has time to work on their desk because they're interviewing all day. I was in an office of, I don't know, there's not less than 50 people in Omaha, and they take 1,200 phone calls a day now.
You're saying staff cutbacks, Phil? Is that what you're talking about?
We haven't hired anybody at Social Security in 3.5 years.
But Phil, at the same time, everybody can see the budget has gone up and up, and our deficits are very big. What are we supposed to do?
Well, I think what we do is we acknowledge that our tax revenues are at the same level they were when Eisenhower was president. We're in a different world now. We have to increase our basic tax revenues to cover basic structures. Mm-hmm. You know, I fly a little bit. I don't want to wait 6 hours to get through security. They cut those TSP people. That's going to happen. I don't want to get on a plane that hasn't had some security.
Yep.
So, you know, we're in a real bind here, and I think part of the real problem is I heard the lady who's leading the Tea Party Express say at one time when the debate was going on about health care that we don't need a health care bill because if you're sick, you just go to an emergency room. Well, who pays for the emergency
room? Yeah, we've seen how well that works out. I know there's a little, and of course, Grover Norquist drowned government in the bathtub. So it makes it kind of hard to be perfectly confident that some people really care about some essential services. On the other hand, Scott Lilly, that deficit is big.
Well, the deficit's big, but my point, and I think the air traffic controller made this point, and certainly this gentleman makes mm-hmm. the point. I think the sequester will actually increase the deficit. And the reason
Why?
Is that if you take $400 million out of the Federal Aviation Administration and you lay off 10,000 air traffic controllers per day, which is what I think he said. I mean, you not only affect those people, you affect the airline industry, you affect all of the people that have concessions in the airport, you affect all of the hotels around the airport. I think the economic consequence here is much greater than the estimated 1 million jobs that people say, because it's not just that you're taking $85 billion out of the economy, which is what the econometric people look at,
yep,
but you're doing it in a way that affects numerous industries. If you lay off the meat inspectors that the Agriculture Department's talking about, you hit the whole pork, cattle, and beef industry.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about sequestration right in front of us now. A week from Friday, it begins to kick in. What it will look like, mean, if it hits, why we are at this point. Dan Mitchell's with us from the Cato Institute in Washington. Scott Lilly is with us from the Center for American Progress there. Over the weekend, Dave Gregory on NBC's Meet the Press talked with the new White House Chief of Staff, Dennis McDonough. Gregory pressed him 3 times on whether the president would stick to his reelection campaign pledge that sequestration would not happen. This is as specific as McDonough could get.
Will he do something to stop this from happening, the automatic cuts from happening?
He will continue to make very reasonable and balanced proposals, as he has time and time again, David. And we look forward to working with our Republican friends and colleagues in the House and Senate to ensure that it doesn't happen.
Reasonable and balanced. Tea Party doesn't think so. Here's Rand Paul again, Republican Senator, Kentucky, in his rebuttal to the President's State of the Union address last week, calling the sequestration cuts not cuts at all.
The President does this big, oh, woe is me, over the $1.2 trillion sequester cuts in spending that he endorsed and he signed into law. Some Republicans are now joining him. Few people understand that the sequester doesn't even cut any spending. It just slows the rate of growth. Only in Washington could an increase in $7 trillion in spending over a decade be called a cut.
There's the Rand Paul view. We've got a lot of listeners calling in. Adela in Milford, Connecticut. Adela, you're on the air.
Hi to everybody. I have a question. I'm a mother of a Naval Academy daughter, and she's in the Naval Academy, and she already has been hit with cuts in the budget. My question is, I mean, how far, I mean, that could go when we're preparing officers. And last class, there were some students that they came and said, well, thank you very much, but we don't have money. Then we thank you for your intention of service and you can go home. Then how far the cuts can go in order to, I mean, since already have been cuts in the Department of Defense at that time.
Adela, we've got it. Dan, how about it? Adela's daughter's in the Naval Academy. She's looking forward, likely, to a career in the Navy. So if Adela looks out, you know, there, when Republicans look out there, what do you see coming with the sequestration tack?
Well, total defense spending will climb, not be cut, will climb by $100 billion over the next 10 years with the sequester. Currently, the United States spends 46% of the entire world's military outlays, and our allies spend another 25%. So if we slightly slow the growth of defense spending, I think that's a prudent and responsible and reasonable thing to do, given the size of our military spending compared to the rest of the world and compared to the fact that there's no longer a Soviet empire.
That sounds like an interesting climate change. Is the inviability of defense spending in the Republican Party a thing of the past now, Dan?
I think a lot of Republicans realize that spending a lot of money on sort of fruitless nation-building exercises around the world isn't such a good idea. In some sense, I think the GOP learned from some of the mistakes of the Bush year, where Bush doubled total government spending and also got us sort of ensnared in some big losses of blood and treasure by trying to turn some of these countries in the Middle East into modern democracies, which a lot of Republicans, I think, understand that's not very realistic now.
Gears of politics turning here. Randy in Corydon, Indiana. Randy, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Couple of questions.
Mm-hmm.
How will the sequester affect disabled veterans, retirement pay, Social Security disability pay, with say credit card companies having this universal default thing? If a person is late on a utility bill, then the interest rates on their credit cards go up.
Yeah.
We want to see a wave of bankruptcies and perhaps another wave of mortgage foreclosures.
Randy, I don't know if we can speak to the credit card company policy, though I know that bites a lot of people. But Scott, what about for disabled veterans? Veterans benefits, I guess Social Security disability would be untouched, as I understand this. What about veterans benefits, Scott?
The Congress exempted the entire Veterans Administration, both the disability benefits and the health service, so that's not touched. But that's one reason that the cuts are bigger for the rest of the government.
Right. Let's go to Mac in Montezuma, Iowa. Mac, you're on.
Well, hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm calling. I'm listening to how everything's going to fall apart. We're not going to have meat inspectors. We're not going to have aircraft tower people. I worked for USDA in facility.
Okay.
We are billed every month for every hour that the inspectors spend in that facility. So nothing's coming. If you cut the inspectors, you're cutting their income, but it's not, there's no gain.
So in other words, the meat packing company, you're saying, pays for the inspector's time on the line?
Yes.
Well, I don't know how to get that far down in the budget. Scott, do you know why are we cutting meat inspectors?
He's exactly right.
Well, then why cut them?
We're not saving money with this thing. We are forcing cuts in programs where the program is actually funded by fee for service.
Can't the USDA get around that? Say no, we won't cut that. It's covered.
Nope. I mean the law that was passed by Congress mandates across the board cuts, just as Alan West and the other Tea Party people demanded, and that's what they have to do.
I don't know why we have to be dumb. Aaron in Omaha. Aaron, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. It aggravates me what one of the people that's on your show today mentioned earlier. They said that the Americans just have to accept cuts to things like Social Security and Medicare because the cost keeps spiraling up and up. Well, this is another problem that was designed by the Congress. The Congress passed a law where we actually said Medicare is not allowed by law to negotiate drug prices with the drug companies for its beneficiaries. However, the Department of Veterans Affairs and every other federal agency can do it.
So they can't use the leverage of their huge size to hold these costs down.
We're talking $500 billion over a 10-year period. Economist Dean Baker came up with the most conservative scenario of more like $300 billion. That's a lot of real money. Why do we have to give up what it is that we've worked for? I paid for this.
Yep.
I want that benefit, but Congress goes and gives something away to the pharmaceutical companies, and now I have your guest sitting on your show telling me I have to give up my benefits?
Suck it
That's
up.
Not fair.
Dan Mitchell, how about it? Design it better, and we don't have to sacrifice here.
Well, first, the left-wing Urban Institute has shown that the average Medicare beneficiary only pays for one-third of the expected benefits they'll receive. So your caller, yes, he's paid in to some extent for things like Medicare, but he's getting a lot more out of the system. That's why there's such a huge, giant, multi-trillion-dollar unfunded liability.
Why the giveaway to the pharmaceutical companies there?
Well,
why?
That's a question that we should all be asking the Obama White House, because
Obama
they're the
White
ones
House?
Who... Yeah, because as part of Obamacare, they got the pharmaceutical administration, the pharmaceutical companies got endorsed it in exchange for very favorable treatment.
But this goes way back before Obamacare.
On the table repeatedly, and the Congress has rejected this, and that provision alone would make up far more than what the sequestration would cost this year.
And I have no problem with getting better prices out of the pharmaceutical companies, but the question that you should be asking this question to the Obama administration, which got the support of the industry. The industry spent millions of dollars on behalf of Obamacare precisely because they got favorable treatment. Now, at the end of the day, if we do wind up doing something to pharmaceutical prices, we do have to be cautious about price controls and whether that affects future R&D and things like that. So it's not a free lunch to go after it. But by all means, yes, the government should use its purchasing power to try to get a better deal. But I don't want to just make it seem like it's solely the fault of the Obama White House with that corrupt deal to get backing for Obamacare. The pharmaceutical industry gives a lot of money to Republicans as well.
Lot of history there. Don in South Windsor, Connecticut. Don, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Basically, I've been following this very carefully as a former CFO. The whole sequestration is an absolute joke. Basically, you're talking about a reduction of 3%. The spending is about $3.6 trillion, about 3%. One of the things that your people should be telling whoever's on your program is that this reduction that they talk about, like $1.2 trillion over 10 years, is the same $100 billion each year. I've got a copy of the president's budget that he issued last year, February 13, 2012. Costs are going up every year by about 4.5%. In other words, costs are going up. There is no cost reduction or savings. What you have is cost avoidance. As one of your people said before, if I've got a budget of 100 and I forecast I'm going to spend 10 and then I cut it to 5, I haven't got a cost savings. I've got a cost...
Don, I take your point, but why are we chopping off our thumb here instead of doing this in a smart way? If we want to get to real reduction over time, why not do it in a smart way over time, Don?
It is, because there's too many political people involved that have got earmarks in this. Everybody's got a vested interest in it. The military has got it. Human services, education, everybody. The only way you can do it is to say there is a smart way to do it, but it never be accepted. So you just cut.
Yeah, Dominic, we've got that perspective, and certainly there are bigger numbers here than the sequestration numbers, but why even wade into it this way when everybody knows it's not a real fix? Aaron in Dubuque, Iowa. Aaron, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
You know, the one thing I keep hearing from everybody is, how is this going to affect me? What's the effect on me going to be? And I feel like that's the mentality that we criticize our politicians for having. And I know it's a little, you know, euphoric, but I think if we got to a point where we said, how is this going to affect us, and how is this going to affect our communities, and what are the effects on things outside of just my little world going to be, we might be able to take a more intelligent perspective at this. It wouldn't be such an emotional issue.
Well, I mean, I agree, and it certainly does come down to individual jobs for some people, but there's a lot of shared, you know, meat inspection, that's us. Air traffic, that's us. Research for the long term, that's us. But I think people are reasonably want to know why we can't get a smart grand bargain out of Congress and out of the White House, Scott. I mean, John McCain, we heard him earlier in the hour, said it's the president's job to lead on this and lead us to something better. Why aren't we there?
Well, I think the Constitution is the reason. We have a system of checks and balances, and if the American people elect a group of people to the House of Representatives that refuse to move off of their position, then that's where we're stuck until they're replaced. We have a mindset in this country that is fairly prevalent now that didn't really exist 40 years ago, and that sort of libertarian anti-government cut anything you can with whatever means possible attitude is unfortunately the one that dominates the politics of the House of Representatives right now.
Dan, why should Americans trust, let's say, Tea Party conservatives to come in and reasonably negotiate over this, our way to some kind of good balance here, when we do have people saying outright that they want to cut things a lot of Americans want in their budget and many are willing to pay for?
First of all, there are no cuts. Even the Ryan budget would have allowed government spending to grow 3.1% a year. As I've already pointed out, under the sequester, government spending grows $2.4 trillion a year instead of $2.5 trillion a year. Let's focus on what really is important. You had a caller talking about, you know, let's do something for the country. Well, right now, if we leave government on autopilot, if we follow the tax and spend policies that Scott and the president and a few others want, we will wind up like Greece. Now, the world is a laboratory. We're seeing the results of the experiment in the welfare state. It's a disaster. If you want to look at people suffering real hardship, look at the people in Greece and Spain, Italy and Portugal and some of the other failing welfare states. There you are talking about, 20%, 25% unemployment. You're talking about five-year recessions. You're talking true misery because you go too far down this path to big government, to dependency. You inevitably wind up with an economic and a fiscal crisis. And if you look at the sequester, if you look at the Ryan budget, these are very modest proposals to slightly reduce the growth of government spending, give the private sector a chance to catch up and generate more
wealth.
The
private sector's up in arms about the sequester. You got CEOs by the busload coming to Washington and say, don't
do this. Oh,
yeah.
If you're from Lockheed or some other government contractor and you have your snout buried in the public trough, of course you're coming to Washington and you're complaining because it's lining your bottom line to have big government spending programs. I'm talking about the real private sector, the private economy that generates the tax base to finance these programs.
I don't
think
they were
for sequestration. If government grows faster than the private sector,
yeah,
in the long run, you become Greece. It's that simple. We have to restrain the growth of government so it stops growing faster than the private sector.
I just don't know why we can't do it in a more reasonable way. Why can't we talk this thing through? And I mean, Scott, are the ideological poles, even now when we look at something like sequester, ugly as it is, so far apart that we just can't have a reasonable conversation? What are Americans supposed to think of that?
Well, we have an issue, and that is we've got a lot more people turning 65 every year than we used to have. And they're going to be a much bigger part of the population, and that means that government's going to have to spend more. Or we're going to have to reduce those benefits, cut Social Security benefits and Medicare benefits. And we've got to either pay for those benefits or not. The problem with spending is not in the vast majority of federal programs. They're frozen. They're diminishing. We have to make a decision about what we want to do with that. And I think the reason that this conversation gets so amalgamated into all of these other issues is that Dan and his friends don't want to take on this retirement issue straight on. They don't want to say what we're really talking about is a dramatic cut in Social Security benefits.
We did it on our side with the Ryan budget. It's the president that has not put forward anything to deal with our long-term fiscal crisis because he figures he'll be out of office by the time the Greek
crisis
hits.
Governor Romney walked away from that budget as quickly as he could.
Romney was about as far from a Tea Party guy as you can imagine.
He was the nominee,
Obama.
And meanwhile, the public watches all this and wonders when we find a sensible way through it. Scott Lilly at the Center for American Progress, we appreciate your time and thoughts today. Dan Mitchell at the Cato Institute, the same to you. We thank you both for being with us. Listeners, tomorrow we're looking at American prison populations, their enormous size, and some states saying they're now fed up with the cost of that and the mandatory sentencing that has produced it. Join us. Thanks for being with us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.